Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is returning guest, David Cates. He's president and CEO of Denison Mines. David, how are you today?
Tom, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. David, I thought we could start by discussing the recent price action in uranium. We've seen spot price go up $10 in the recent months here. Could you tell us a little bit about the fundamentals of why that's happening right now?
Yeah, Tom, it's actually not a whole bunch of stuff happening that's precipitated it. It really is linked to COVID-19. But to say it's COVID-19 is an oversimplification. You know, the market's been correcting itself for several years, and that's really set the stage for COVID-19 to catalyze things in our space. And it's really reminded us, and I kind of want to unpack this a bit, but it's reminded us just how different our commodity is from the others and how fragile supply side is in the uranium and nuclear energy business. And I guess maybe if I just dive into that, what we've seen in response to COVID-19 is several uranium mine shutdowns, but really it's focused on Cameco having shut the Cigar Lake mine, and that was producing 18 million pounds a year. It was the largest single supply source for the uranium market. And, you know, just to back up a little bit, that's because the McArthur River mine had been shut a few years earlier in response to low prices. And that McArthur River mine was also another 18 million pounds. So you can see from those two mines in Saskatchewan, northern Saskatchewan, you have 36 million pounds that have come off the market. 18 million right now reaction at Cigar Lake to COVID-19. And at the same time, you've seen the Kazakhs announce that they have restricted activity in Kazakhstan around their minefield development. And remember, they use a different mining method in Kazakhstan. They use in-situ recovery. And so for them, they're not really able to just turn off their mines. They will keep producing a little bit as the mines slow down and as they stop developing new wells. It also means that it'll take them time to turn it back on. It won't just go straight back to sort of a nameplate capacity. And so those two, Kazakhs are estimating, you know, 10 million pounds of production are going to be lost on a short-term shutdown. And we'll see how long Cigar stays shut. But really, when you take a market that was already in a primary deficit by a significant amount from previous shutdowns, and you take these shutdowns on top, the supply side has really just collapsed. And on the demand side, you've got nuclear power plants that are running uninterrupted. You know, they're the baseload energy. They're what's there providing power to the hospitals and to the infrastructure. And so if we look at it at a really big picture level, you've just seen the price have to react to the fact that demand is constant, but supply has really dried up. And you've got utilities that were ready to get into the market, and you've got traders that are ready to front run them, and people looking at this as the beginning of a very long-term cycle of contracting.
Before the call, we were speaking about some of the effects of COVID-19, especially on Cameco in the Athabasca Basin there. Could you elaborate on that for us, please?
Yeah, COVID-19, you know, you can debate the extent of which it affects some of these operations, mining operations globally. And, you know, we get updates all the time from a variety of bankers, and they tell us, you know, there's 200 or 300 different mining operations that have been curtailed in response. But you got to remember where Cigar Lake uses the example, where it's located. It's in northern Saskatchewan, and when we say northern, you know, it's remote northern Saskatchewan. And it's, you know, if we go up, it's a couple hours by charter plane, but, you know, it's a day on the road to get there from Saskatoon. And so it's just not the kind of area that's built for a health crisis. You know, it's sparsely populated and really isolated from south, where you have greater density, and of course you then have different capacity for these types of crises because you have different infrastructure. And The concern in the north is really that the virus could spread quickly because of the way people live in different in communities. They often are sparsely populated but dense within the community. And the health infrastructure is just not the same. And so there's a real concern from the indigenous leaders and the community leaders in the north that if COVID-19 gets there, then it could spread rapidly and be catastrophic. And, you know, it's one of the things we have to have perspective for is it takes time, and it has taken time, for the virus to spread across the world. And so the north being isolated, it hadn't really got there when Cigar Lake was shut in mid to late March. It was proactive measure by Cameco, but frankly, a smart one, because in the last few weeks, the virus has reached the north of Saskatchewan. And it's a very concerning situation. We had seen almost no cases, and then small outbreak, 4 or 5 cases. And now the province is reporting that in the north and in the far north, you're into the 50-plus, 100-plus cases. And that's in a province, Saskatchewan, where cases in the south have pretty much dried up. And so it is basically a new outbreak in the north. And it is concerning for sure for those leaders, because it's what they were worried about in terms of how will they control this in the north, where people really rely on the few bits of infrastructure and it's difficult to isolate. And so when you think about all of that, and you think about the fact that Cigar Lake's already been shut for several weeks, and Cameco's extended that shutdown sort of indefinitely, subject to COVID-19 and subject the uranium market, is what they've guided in some of their public statements, you do start to realize that, wow, if the north of Saskatchewan is, you know, say 4 or 5 weeks behind where we might have been, hey, in Ontario or in the south of Saskatchewan or in the United States, unfortunately, they've got a rough ride ahead. And that probably suggests that you're going to see the mine shut longer than people might be handicapping if they think of Cigar Lake as just being part of Saskatchewan. I think to do that and to hear people talking about opening up business in Saskatchewan again would really be missing the point for what's actually happening in the north. And, you know, I think the right thing to do would be to keep operations in the north shut as those communities deal with what is right now a real hot zone in the province, rather than saying, hey, in Saskatoon, everything's looking better. Let's get going back up in the north. I mean, that doesn't make sense. It's not the same part of town.
That's very interesting, and maybe that's something that a lot of people are missing right now. Another reason we wanted to have you back right now, David, you guys just released your Q1 report, and you guys are also affected by COVID with some of your PEA stuff. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, Tom, it's, you know, I put my quote into the news release that we put out last night, and really a heartfelt quote in a way, writing to a couple of audiences, one of them, the folks in northern Saskatchewan. You know, I wanted to talk about the things that we've done to support those communities and just to rally them around their resilience, but also to our staff and our investors, because, you know, we've had such a successful last, I'll call it, 12 months. Advancing Phoenix, which is that super high-grade uranium deposit at our flagship 90% owned Wheeler River project. You know, Phoenix is over 19% average grade. It's the highest grade undeveloped uranium deposit in the world. And we're building on a pre-feasibility study that we put out just over 2 years ago around using the in-situ recovery mining method in Saskatchewan for the first time. And over the last 12 months, we've been focused on proving up that mining method because it hasn't been used in Saskatchewan before, but it has so much potential, you know, and the potential where we could be the lowest cost producer, OPEX and all in the world. And honestly, I have a very good environmental story associated with it too, based on what we're doing. And last year, we spent something like 23 weeks in the field, completing actual ISR field tests, drilling wells into the ground, moving water from well to well to map out the hydrogeology, and starting to get to a feasibility study level of technical understanding so that we could really de-risk this mining method. And, you know, again, a bit of a long background on this, but, you know, earlier this year, in the beginning of 2020, we put out some really impressive results on two fronts. One was the hydraulic conductivity, you know, a bit of a technical term, but really it's talking about our ability to move solution through the well field. And we confirmed that we could achieve the rate of hydraulic conductivity that we've assumed in the pre-feasibility study, which is from one of our commercial wells, which is really a significant de-risking result, because there's a lot of assumptions that go into these kind of studies. And we've now taken a commercial well that we put in the ground, and we've said, look, we can get the rate of hydraulic conductivity that we've assumed. And we also ran some metallurgy and on an intact piece of core, and we discovered that, you know, we actually could recover two or three times more uranium than we modeled in the PFS when we leach it. And so that's all amazing when it comes to de-risking our ability to produce 6 million pounds a year from an ISR mine at Phoenix. And so that set the stage for where we were this year. COVID-19 hits, we're confronted with what to do. And we decided to suspend the environmental assessment for the project and some of this feasibility study work. And again, you know, the message in the quote was very much just one speaking to our staff about how that truly was the right thing to do. I mean, of course we want to build on all that positive momentum. Of course we want to keep moving the project forward. We're motivated more than ever, and we're more confident than ever in the mining method. But right now we're in the middle of an environmental assessment, and a really critical part of that process is consulting and talking to community members and interested parties, regulators, community leaders, indigenous leaders, regular people that, you know, trappers that could be impacted by our project. And I think you can see where I'm going, because it's a little bit tough to do consultation in the far north the way you want to do it when you're in a COVID-19 health crisis. You know, you can't really do this stuff while physical distancing. And frankly, you may not want to be in those communities, because the communities may not want you coming from Saskatoon and bringing the virus or this or that with you. And we decided to pause the process. And, you know, it's a disappointing thing for us around the technical side of it and in our momentum. But I'll tell you, everyone is really confident that we made the right choice. We made the choice early. We were a leader in the sector in northern Saskatchewan doing that. I mean, we made this announcement before Cigar Lake went down, and it was absolutely the right thing to do when you look at what's happened in the north since then. So what we're doing, though, is positioning ourselves for a quick and a swift restart. And a couple of ways you could respond to COVID-19, and our choice has been to dial down some of the external work that's going on in that project, of course, not go to the communities, but to keep our entire team intact internally. All of the key people are on and have been retained. Our vice presidents are all with us. We haven't let anyone go senior, and we have not let anyone go that's on the support or operational level either. We have found work that's meaningful for all of these people. They're all working from home right now in Saskatoon, and their objective is to do the work that's quietly important during this interim time, and to get us ready so that when the market and when the communities are ready for us to come back and resume activity, we are further ahead than we were, and we've minimized the impact to our schedule. And I'll tell you, I'm really impressed with how our people have responded to that call. You know, it would be easy to be disappointed, you know, and to be demotivated by the delay. The team has really stepped up, actually, and they're working on some really clever things that will minimize the impact to schedule and are probably going to save us money at the end of the day by using our internal team instead of outside consultants on some of these projects. So, you know, that's how we're responding to it. It's, you know, we're not a mining company, we're a development company, but, you know, there's still complex choices you need to make. And the choice we're making is to set ourselves up for this project to go forward and lead the pack and be the next new uranium mine in Canada.
Sounds like a very responsible way to go about things, David. We've seen your Q1 results release, and Cameco's call was the other day as well. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so our results, a lot of it we've touched on here in the call, but one thing really important that that you'll see in our results, and then we'll turn to Cameco. One thing important in our results is you'll see that our working capital position has been shored up really nicely. You know, the company raised some money in the depths of the COVID-19, I'll call it, liquidity crisis, which I think really flexed our muscle as in terms of having access to capital basically under any circumstance. And that financing was really well supported by some, you know, well-known institutional investors that are in the uranium space, but also really importantly, the Lundin family. So Jack Lundin is one of our directors. This is one of Lucas Lundin's sons. And of course, Lucas had been on our board for a very long time. And the Lundin family continues to have Denison as its primary investment in the uranium space. And so we were very pleased that the Lundins would support us in such a volatile time. But it means that we're in good shape financially here, and you'll see that in those first quarter results. We've updated our outlook, so that's also in those results. And when you put those two together, you can see that we've got a lot of runway here to see the market respond to COVID-19. Of course, the uranium price is up, the share price is up. We really just need a few more signals to tell us that it's time to go back to work, and we're not quite there yet. But you can see even financially, we're set up nicely for that as well. And really, other thing to note just on that financing, and then I do want to go to Cameco, is that it was done on a short-form prospectus. And so, you know, without getting into too much of the technical details here, that's not a private placement. That means there's no four-month hold on that stock. That means there's no mark your calendar 4 months out to see somebody blow out that stock. You know, we've put it with really responsible people, and it was free trading from the first day that deal closed. And so there's really no reason to be watching for a market reaction on that financing, even though people have done really well who participated in that financing because the share price has gone up. There's no shoe left to drop in terms of what happens to the share price in response to that. That stock was liquid the day it was distributed. Now on Cameco, you know, I've been obviously following their announcements very closely, and they've had a number of public announcements or presentations or chats that have been available on the internet from various brokers. And they kind of did their analyst call a little bit differently. They made everybody write in their questions, and they didn't take them on a live phone stream, which is normally what they do. I don't know what was going on there, but they still covered a lot of material. Some of it was repetitive of some of the other sessions that I've heard them talking on. But, you know, I think the themes that if someone hasn't listened to these Cameco calls, the themes that I draw out of it is that Cameco is not shy talking about when they will turn Cigar back on, and the fact that Cigar Lake startup or resuming production at Cigar Lake isn't expressly linked to COVID-19. In fact, it's expressly been linked by Cameco to the commercial market and the uranium market. And I'm not sure that that's obvious to people. Unless, you know, if you've listened, it's obvious. But if you haven't been listening to Cameco, this is not, they have not presented this as a shutdown and restart linked exclusively to the health crisis. They've said it's a shutdown related to the health crisis, but it is a restart that they've said will be motivated by the market and the price of uranium. And to go even as far as to say in some of the remarks, and of course I'm paraphrasing everything, but to note that the health crisis is actually, I think their description was that it was commercially aligned or aligned with Cameco's commercial objectives, you know, to be able to shut down this mine. To have this, you know, to think that this mine at Cigar is going to just zip back on, you know, as soon as the North deals and stabilizes and deals with this, the growing outbreak up there. I don't think that's the right way to look at this. You know, Cameco has no obligation to go out and make those kind of comments. They've withdrawn their guidance. I mean, they could sit tight and just say, well, we're going to watch to see how the situation evolves. But they've done the opposite. They've come out and said, no, it's going to be commercially motivated. Now, if we peel underneath that, peel the skin under and look under the skin, you know, they're probably doing that to make sure the nuclear utilities get the message. You know, it's great for you and I and investors to hear that. I think it helps us try to handicap when the mine comes back. But the message is probably designed for the utilities so that they don't sit in their procurement boardrooms and say, well, let's just wait this out. You know, these mines will come right back on and the uranium price will go back down. You know, it's up 45% in 6 weeks. Let's just wait. I think Cameco is trying to be really clear to the utilities that, yeah, the uranium price up 45% in 6 weeks, still a long way to go before they start their mines back up. And by the way, Cigar's not coming right back. So maybe you guys in that procurement boardroom should be thinking a little more hard about whether we should pick up the phone and call Cameco and talk about the next wave of contracts. So that's a theme for sure. You know, the other theme that came out of the conference call was, it was actually Cameco providing some color on Kazatomprom. And of course, Cameco and Kazatomprom are partners at Inkai in Kazakhstan. But they were commenting on an interview that the CEO, Galim Pirmatov of Kazatomprom, had given to the UX Weekly, which is a trade publication that many of us follow in the uranium place and space, and UX is one of our primary price reporters. And I will say that interview, you know, if people can get their hands on it, they should, because it was excellent. Galim Pirmatov did a very good job, very clear responses, and it really was powerful to see the level of organization that Kazatomprom has achieved in terms of its commercial strategy. And there's a number of points in that interview that are highlights, but I think what I'd say is that we're really seeing Kazatomprom act with much more commercial insight and intelligence. And it, of course, informed differently now that they've IPO'd than they would have previously. And I was really impressed with the clarity they brought, that Galim brought to some of those questions around the shutdown, this temporary shutdown in response to COVID-19, and explaining how slow it is and how long it takes to resume production with the ISR wellfield development. And also the way he talked about stopping the use of traders and Kazatomprom moving away from the spot market and trying to become a customer-focused company. That's really helpful for our space, that Kazatomprom would be turning off the tap to the traders, because this is maybe a little bit too much of a deep dive, but historically, Kazakhs would often be selling all their production, basically, you know, produced at the mine and delivered, you know, as produced to traders. And the traders would then go and market the material globally. And Kazatomprom didn't really have a commercial group to build customer relationships. And as part of their whole IPO and commercialization process, they brought in the trading house. But why is that so important? It's important because if they stop feeding those traders, it really undermines the traders' ability to execute these carried trades. And the carried trade had been a utility favorite and a bit of a market damaging process, because the traders were taking spot material, maybe from Kazakhstan or surplus, using cheap money in the capital markets and just buying it and loaning it, if you will, or financing it over 3 or 5 years. And it meant that the utilities didn't have to go and call up the real producers and enter into price discovery discussions about what price do you need, you know, on the cost curve to be able to incent new production or to be able to incent a 10-year contract. They weren't doing it because the traders were just taking excess material and flopping it out to them on 3-year deals. And so the fact that Kazatomprom is tightening that up and moving away from the traders means that the traders are not going to have an important source for that carried trade. And it, to me, and this is where Cameco is going with it, and I agree with them, it means that the utilities will again have to start looking at procuring from producers, whether it be Kazatomprom, whether it be Cameco, whether it be the Denisons, you know, in this cycle to build new mines. They're going to have to look at talking to us about entering into those contracts and actually discovering what price is required, rather than just leaning on that carried trade. And that was something I think that was maybe subtle in the call, but honestly might be one of the biggest points that people need to know about.
Some excellent highlights there from you, David. As of course, we know under the umbrella of Denison Mines, we also have Uranium Participation Corp, or UPC. How are things going over there?
Well, that's a loaded question in a way, Tom, but things are going fine. And UPC's share price has done very well, of course, along with the uranium price. So uranium price up 45%. UPC's gone from as low as 320 during that liquidity crisis at the beginning of this COVID-19 reaction to over $5. And this is all Canadian numbers. It's been more volatile than that uranium price, because at that 320 range, UPC was actually trading at a 30%, give or take, discount to its underlying net asset value. Today, we're probably in the range of a 15% discount. So, we've taken all of that uranium price lift, the 45%, and we've trimmed the discount in half. So it's been a pretty good ride for UPC shareholders. So that said, loaded question, because we're still trading at a 15% discount to NAV. And so it does mean that really UPC is the cheapest way and the lowest risk way for investors to dip their toe into the uranium space, because if we're at $34 uranium, 10% discount, we'll just do the quick math, would be 340 off. So it's another $1.50 and change on top of that. So you're barely paying, $30 per pound when you're buying UPC. You're actually probably getting it just under that. So that's a bargain, but it's frustrating to us to see that discount persist. Now, we haven't sat idly by. We did put out a securities instrument in Canada called the Normal Course Issuer's Bid, and this has all been press released, and it's all known. And what you'll see in that is that we have the ability to buy back our shares on the TSX to be able to defend that discount to NAV. And so we can actually be a buyer and pick up our shares. And remember UPC's model, I'll just distill it really quick. For UPC, all we try to do is maximize the pounds U308 equivalent per share. And so when we trade at a premium to NAV, The way to do it is you raise money at a premium to your underlying asset value, and then you take that money and you go buy underlying assets, uranium, at the market price. And at the end of the day, you will add pounds per share doing that. And it's the flip side now at a discount is when you have a significant discount, what you would do and what you should do is take working capital or sell uranium and buy back stock. And at the end of the day, you'll sell less uranium proportionally to the stock you buy back, and you'll actually add pounds per share. And that really should add value to the remaining shareholders. So with that normal course issuer bid, we now have the latitude to do that on the market. There's rules around how much we can buy back in a given day and what the maximums are. But we put out our monthly NAV news release for UPC last night, recently. You'll see that we have been active on that. And so part of the reason you will have seen that discount to NAV reduce is because we have been buying back shares and we have sold some uranium. And they're not big amounts of uranium, but it does allow us to be funded by doing that to buy back that stock. And so, UPC is doing well. We're trading at a much lower discount to NAV than our peer in the UK, Yellowcake. We have better liquidity. And so we are battling this discount to NAV. I think what's a little bit unclear is what's the discount coming from? Is it that there's a skepticism around the uranium price? In which case, hearing my comments from earlier here on this call, I think that's maybe a buying opportunity, because I don't see the market reaction to COVID-19 reversing very quickly. So maybe that discount, if it's skepticism on the uranium price, maybe that's worth exploiting. Or is it still a lingering market effect from just how significant that liquidity selling was at the beginning. Any of these stocks, if you have a seller just you know, step on a stock, it does take time for those buyers to come back in and buy it back up to a reasonable place. And maybe the price action's just been too much for some people with the uranium price moving at the same time, that there just hasn't been the depth in the market broadly generally to be able to trade UPC back up to NAV. Of course, with the buyback, we're able to come in and be part of that market and help us get there, which you can definitely see in the numbers. Things are going fine at UPC. Share price is up. The discount to NAV is reducing. Those are all really positive things. We definitely want to see that discount to NAV go down further. And frankly, we'd like to see the sentiment shift to a point where there could be a premium on that company. And as soon as we swing into that territory, you know, we're ready to go raise money, buy uranium, replace any uranium we sold, buy more. And that has the ability to then tighten up that uranium market even further. If we go from being a small seller to a big lumpy buyer in a market that's already constrained, I mean, that could be really powerful for the uranium price.
Absolutely. Some great insights there. Do you have any concluding thoughts as we wrap up here, David?
Well, look, I think, you know, I've been on the show a few times, not in a little bit. And I remember being there when Colin made what I'll call the call that we had hit the bottom. And he was right about that. $18 US per pound was the bottom. But what your listeners probably know about me is that we are not baseless promoters. Running UPC, we have a lot of market intel, market insight, but also our approach to running Denison is one of being cautious and realistic, because we are trying to actually build a uranium mine and be smart in terms of navigating capital markets to get there. But what I see right now is a real opportunity for this uranium market to enter a new proper procurement cycle. And we've always said, as we've gone through all of these other price reactions, and many people will accuse the uranium market of having false starts. I don't know that that's fair. We were at $18 a pound. We are now at $34 a pound. Yes, we've gone up and down in between there. Well, everything does that. So I don't know that those are false starts. But, you know, I do see this as being substantive. The pressure that's been put on the supply side really should rattle the utilities into action. Their inventories are down in the U.S. They've been out of the market for 2 years as we went through all this trade uncertainty with a Section 232 petition and a nuclear fuel working group. The ingredients are set for the utilities to have to come to the market. And unfortunately for them, they're going to come to the market at a time when supply is constrained, and at a time when the picture of how fragile the supply side is has never been more clear. To have one or two operators go down and the entire supply side to collapse just tells them that they need to focus on long-term procurement. They need to focus on having alternate suppliers. They need Denison. You know, they need companies like us to be in the mix to diversify their supplies. This feels quite substantive and real to me. And I would say that Cameco's conviction to buy uranium is also really accelerated in the last few weeks. And that's important. You know, if they are out there buying because they have no meaningful producing assets, the price, and they have a lot of buying to do, the price will sustain until those utilities come in, and then they will start to pay more. And, you know, I don't think this is a false start. And I think there's a lot of things that are really going our way at a time when other commodities, you know, park gold, but like other bulk commodities, maybe are questioning how will the world economy respond, and can you expect the price of copper, iron ore, all these other things to rise if you don't know what economic activity looks like. We don't have that issue here. We've got nuclear power plants that are running. We've got China committing to their builds. They're saying they're still on schedule with their new builds. Meanwhile, we've got the utilities hopefully opening their eyes to the reality of the supply side, and I think that's real, you know. And so I would leave the listeners with that. Just there's a really good fundamental case here for this to not be just a temporary COVID-19 price reaction. There's a lot of real ingredients here that could see this be the beginning of the recovery. And $34 uranium is not the end game. Cameco needs, and they've guided, and I believe in their resolve to get $40 to $50 uranium. And that's probably not the end of the story either, because Cameco can only sell so much uranium, and the demand story looks pretty good. And I think we're going to see people test, well, what's after Cameco's production once this procurement cycle gets going? And that's where people can get excited about how high the price goes. You know, Denison doesn't need the price to go to 40 or 50. You know, with this ISR method at Phoenix, I mean, we made money at $24, pretty good money. We would do great at $34. We'd do even better at $44, and then even better at $54. But I think there's not very many like us that can do that. And so when you do look at the cost curve and you go back to, okay, people are going to start to discover the price and, you know, get back to first principles about how commodities are priced, there's a really good case to say that prices go well beyond $50. And so, you know, and that's contract prices. Spot prices, if things tighten up somewhere down the line again, can go even higher. And I do think there's a lot of runway in this commodity ahead. And I would want the listeners to know that our view is that this has the potential to be a real cycle catalyst, not just a sort of short-term spike catalyst. And, you know, definitely watch for those signs to make your decisions on your investments. Watch for some of those signs around some of the points I'm talking about to see whether that's materializing or not. But I'm very positive around where it will go. And we're not normally out there talking about these kind of things unless we think it's really backed up by the fundamentals.
Sounds like a perfect storm moving forward for uranium.
Well, I'm excited. That's for sure. And I just want to get that Phoenix environmental assessment back up and running, so that we can get the mine built and be part of this cycle, and that's important. So we're ready for it. We're trying to get organized, and I do think there's some really good stuff going on in the uranium space right now. Anyways, Tom, it's been a tremendous pleasure actually to give you guys an update.
Absolutely, we really appreciate your time, David. Let everybody know where we can find a little bit more information about you guys.
Yeah, denisonmines.com. You know, we'll have all of your resources for Denison, uraniumparticipation.com for UPC, and definitely look up Denison on Twitter. We've got a pretty good social media content program, industry news, company news. It's a pretty good place to follow us.
Absolutely. I'm just looking at it right now. It's Denison Mines CO on Twitter. David,
right.
Thanks very much for your time today.
Hey, Tom, again, my pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people? Hit the bid.
How violent that term could be? It actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?